Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. He's also the author of The Weed Agency, now available in fine bookstores and online stores as well. We usually have good, bad, and crazy martinis at this point. Jim, today, get ready to spend a little extra time at the bar because they're all bad. No way around it today. So those are just the facts on the ground. We'll start with this latest from the Veterans Administration. We've been following this story in great detail over the past couple of weeks. This from Monday, the Department of Veterans Affairs shed light on the depth of the VA scheduling scandal and substantiated claims that rank-and-file employees were directed to manipulate records. The agency said more than 57,000 new patients have waited at least 90 days for their first appointments, and that about 13% of VA schedulers indicated they were told to falsify appointment request dates to give the impression that wait times were shorter than they really were. This has got folks like Texas Senator John Cornyn saying, okay, now it's time for the FBI to get involved because there's genuine criminal activity here. So this story just gets worse and worse.
It does. I guess if we really wanted to strain and find a good martini, we could say that the acting VA Secretary, Sloan Gibson, isn't sugarcoating it. And he is being public and upfront about the scale of the problem. I still think this qualifies as a thoroughly abominable martini. 57,000. And then, of course, there's another 64,000 who never made it onto, the scale of the problem is mind-boggling. And it indicates just how clearly this was systemic. Clearly, this is not just a few bad apples. Clearly, this is a thoroughly dysfunctional bureaucracy from top to bottom. And it makes it very clear, Shinseki, at this point, there's really no defense for the job Shinseki does. It really shows how galling it is for President Obama to talk about how much he cares about veterans when you've got a problem on this enormous scale going on. And it clearly is going to take a long time to work through that backlog. You got to start thinking about the possibility of giving these guys vouchers and things like that, because clearly these guys are waiting in interminable amounts of times. And, you got to wonder if the VA system has room for another 120,000 patients.
On to the second bad martini, and this story kind of erupted towards the end of last week, and it's continuing today, and that's the flood of illegal immigrants, and particularly teenagers, into areas of Texas, mainly around El Paso, as well as spots in Arizona. You got Jan Brewer saying this is entirely the work of the Obama administration, calling him the reason for this massive influx of illegal crossings and the cost to taxpayers. We're having to deal with the crisis created by the president. That could be potentially due to the fact that when policies change, it attracts obviously more people if they think it's easier to get into the country and perhaps have a shot at a better future. Oddly, at the same time, Republicans are saying that the president's mishandling of this issue shows exactly why we need to entrust him with enforcing new immigration laws. Jim, this problem gets even more dire. There's a humanitarian aspect to this as well, with all these people basically sitting in glorified FEMA camps down in the Southwest and stifling temperatures. And then the political wrangling goes on and on.
The reaction of Republican lawmakers is what makes it from a bad martini to a thoroughly depressing martini. But I just want to observe, there are times where you could argue that the right can be kind of hyperbolic in its discussion of immigration. But this is a fantastic example of how every government policy has unforeseen consequences. And sometimes those consequences are absolutely awful and horrible. And in this case, this is what happens when you talk about the DREAM Act. If you come here illegally as a grown-up, we'll throw you back. But if you come here as a child, we'll take sympathy on you. We're caring and compassionate types, and we'll let you stay. And what happens is this word gets out of this to Mexico and to other countries, and they start saying, okay, we're going to send our kids unaccompanied, which strikes me as just an unimaginable decision to be sending your kids into, very unpopulated areas. Some areas very dangerous. Putting them in the hands of some people smuggler and things like that. Other things kind of fascinating about this is how different the areas are, because there's a fascinating study, in a chart I'm looking at from the Pew Research Center. They divide the border into sectors, 9 sectors of there. There's been around Tucson, Arizona is one that's had a pretty high one. There's been another jump in Del Rio, which is kind of central Texas. Laredo, which is kind of in between the center and not quite to the coast, has had a slight increase. But Rio Grande, which is right up against the Gulf of Mexico coast, in all of last year, they had, I'm going to say, about 12,000 or so. So far this year, through May 31st, they've had 33,000 minors under the age of 17 cross the border. That's an astonishing jump. It's like tripling. And that doesn't happen in a vacuum. And as you mentioned, this is just creating a humanitarian crisis on our border. So here we have this policy that a lot of us suspect is created by very cynical purposes of, look, we want to create potential future Democratic Party voters. We want to create a path to citizenship. And oh, by the way, we want to portray our opponents as cruel and harsh and mean to immigrant children or illegal immigrant children. And here we have a disaster being created on our southern border because we're not really thinking through the consequences of our actions and talking about the possibility of the Dream Act without actually recognizing, you know, where are these kids going to go? What are we going to do with all this? This is one of those cases where even though there's hyperbolic coverage in, you know, some corners of the right, look, sometimes, you know, the facts prove them right. I'm glad Drudge is hammering this. I'm glad Fox News is hammering this. And this is a circumstance that utterly demands reaction from Washington. And of course, I think the president is talking about student loans again today.
And if those two stories weren't depressing enough, I'll just wait till we get into the third one here. Hillary Clinton is now doing public interviews because she's got a book out and she's pretending like she's still trying to decide whether she's running for president when it's pretty clear that she is. Last night, in an hour-long special, Diane Sawyer talked with Hillary Clinton a lot about Benghazi, and kudos to Sawyer for asking some pretty tough questions. It's the answers that are definitely making this the bad martini. We're going to break this up into two parts, one about the security issues leading up to the Benghazi attack, and then the talking points about the YouTube video after. Here's the exchange between Clinton and Sawyer about security.
There was a lack of appreciation and response to the level of threat. Now, there were a lot of...
By you, too?
Well, no, that was never brought to me.
Is there anything you personally should have been doing to make it safer in Benghazi?
Well, what I did was give very direct instructions that the people who have the expertise and experience in security...
But personally,
apply.
You...
Well, that is personal, though, Diane. I am not... I'm not equipped to sit and look at blueprints where the blast walls need to be or where the reinforcements need to be. That's why we hire people who have that expertise. I take responsibility, but I was not making security decisions. I think it would be a mistake for a Secretary of State to sit and say, okay, let's go through all 270 posts and let me decide what should be done.
I take full responsibility, but nothing is my fault, Diane. It's as simple as that. Which kind of raises the question of how she defines responsibility, because even if she thinks everyone under her made the wrong decisions, she's in charge of all the people under her, you know? And I was kind of struck by how often when discussing Benghazi afterwards, she would talk about how close she was to Chris Stevens, how important the mission in Libya was, what a high priority it was to U.S. policy. And then afterwards, she says, well, actually, I was totally out of the loop on the details of this. So there's kind of a contradiction there for starters. If the warnings from Stevens keep getting more and more dire and the requests for security, then the evidence that the security situation in Benghazi keeps building up, piling up higher and higher, what does it take to get it to the secretary's desk? What else was she doing at that time that was so important that the possibility of attacks on our people on September 11th was such an unbelievable, you know, that she couldn't possibly deal with this? Her whole explanation just doesn't make a lot of sense. And, you can kind of see the snippiness in it. Kudos to Diane for the tough question, because basically her attitude is, well, I told my people to take care of it and they didn't. And we've gotten very familiar with that kind of explanation from this administration. You know, I thought the website was going to work, but Sebelius didn't tell me. I thought the veterans were being taken care of by the VA, and Shinseki didn't tell me. And so we have this constant statement of, I had no idea. Nobody ever tells me anything. I just work here or something like that. And, you know, this is an argument for her to be a figurehead, but not actually a genuine leader, not a competent manager, not somebody who's, you know, she doesn't have to go down and examine every single blast wall. You do have to take a look at what the security situation is and should there be a U.S. presence in that city. And if there is, do you have enough there to secure it? And we all looked at that and figured that out way too late. I would just also add one other kind of wrinkle to Hillary's book tour and the Benghazi angle. Jake Tapper has a fantastic item over on CNN.com pointing out that the way she writes it, she makes it sound like there were Marines in Tripoli at that point, but there weren't. She writes accurately that Marines are guarding a U.S. embassy. They're not at every U.S. embassy, and when they are, their first mission is actually to protect the classified information that is within the document. There's another group called the State Department Diplomatic Security Service whose job is to protect embassy personnel. The way Hillary writes it, it sounds as if the Marines were in Tripoli during the night of the attack when they weren't. Now, she's saying things that aren't accurate. that's either a lie designed to make them look more prepared than they were on September 11th, or it's an extraordinarily convenient wording that just happens to make things sound like they were more on the ball than they actually were.
Let's move to the issue with the talking points and the administration blaming the video for weeks after the attack. Diane Sawyer led into that question, then Hillary tried to explain what was going on with the talking points and the blaming of the video.
What was going on was trying in the midst of what, frankly, was the fog of war to figure out what had happened.
You famously said whether it was a protest or a group of guys walking out and deciding to kill some Americans.
What difference at this point does it make?
That's right.
Does it make a difference?
In the moment, it did not. In the moment, what we had to be focused on was saving American lives.
Does it make a difference now? Do you want to change that?
No, I don't. Because the point of what I said at the time was, you know, if you're going to stay fixated on things like talking points or fixated on whether or not everybody was affected or not by the video, you're missing the larger picture.
Jim, I think a lot of people would blanch a lot at suggesting that saving lives was their number one priority that night. And then the idea that she's offended at the politicization of the four deaths is another one.
When she says the fog of war, what all of us are kind of baffled by is how everyone on the ground was giving one clear message. We're under attack. This is a terrorist attack. Nobody said anything about a protest. And yet, as a lot of other folks have noted, is that 6 hours into the attack, a statement came from Hillary Clinton talking about, some have tried to blame this on a videotape, nothing justifies this. And it's very much about Benghazi. This is not a statement about Egypt. It does not refer to Egypt or anything like that. Where the reference to the video came from, like, you know, that night it was coming from Foggy Bottom. It's not like, oh, one person on the ground is saying it's an attack and the other person on the ground is saying it's a protest. The whole protest explanation never came from anybody in Libya. So this whole idea of, well, it's the fog of war, it was confusing. No, actually, it was very clear from the people who were there, and then it just happens to be the people who weren't there and who would politically be the most damaged by the report that a terror attack had killed our ambassador and killed other Americans on September 11th, something you'd figure most competent security forces would be prepped for and be ready for. They were the ones who came up with this alternate explanation, blaming it on a videotape. You know, you could say that's a cynical interpretation of events, but it certainly is Occam's razor, the most likely explanation for events. And she keeps attributing it to this ethereal, somewhere in the atmosphere, fog of war, providing this false explanation. There you go. You know, I can't imagine anybody looks at that exchange and says, oh, we can have great faith in her decision making. That was a great explanation. Over at the Washington Post, Eric Semple, who's their media analyst, says, ABC News' Diane Sawyer destroys Hillary Rodham Clinton on Benghazi, and Wemple is not one of us. He is not somebody we can count on to provide the right-of-center assessment of things. So this has been a very difficult start to her book tour, I think.
Yeah, certainly the case. And the fact that she says Benghazi actually encourages her more to run is curious as well. But Jim, on that depressing note, I guess we've kind of cleared out the bar. See you tomorrow.
Better day tomorrow, folks.
Jim Garrity of National Review, also the author of The Weed Agency. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please join us again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.